This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. So on today's episode, I want to share with you a big idea that's going to help you become smarter, faster, and better, both in life and in business. It's a mindset that is called bullet train thinking. And I came across it in Charles Duhigg's new book titled Smarter, Faster, Better. It's the same guy, by the way, who wrote the book The Power of Habit. Extraordinary book. This one's great too. And in the book, he talks about back in the 1950s, during the lingering wake of the devastation of the Second World War, how Japan was intensely focused on growing the nation's economy. Now, a large portion of the country's population actually lived in or in between the two cities of Tokyo and Osaka, which were both separated by just 320 miles of train track. And I'll tell you why that's important in just a second. But every day, tens of thousands of people traveled between these two cities. And in addition to the thousands of people who traveled on these trains, tons of industrial goods were transported on them as well. Right, but because Japanese had so many mountains spread throughout and in between these two cities of Tokyo and Osaka, that it actually made an already old, busted, outdated railway system even slower due to the rough and mountainous Japanese terrain that the trains were forced to travel on, making the trip that was only 300 miles. You'd think that a 300-mile trip on a train would be pretty quick, right? Well, back then, with how old this railway system was and how mountainous the Japanese terrain was, it actually took 20 hours to make that trip. Imagine if you like worked or had to go to a business meeting or wanted to travel to see a family member, right, from Osaka to the other city, Osaka to Tokyo, or from Tokyo to Osaka. Imagine what a hassle it would be to get on a train for 20 hours and have to get out there, right? It would probably make you want to go a lot less often if it were a much shorter trip, right? Now, in 1955, to solve this problem, the head of the Japanese railway system issued a challenge to the nation's best engineers. He said, "All right, guys, I want you guys to invent a faster train." 6 months later, his team comes back and unveils a prototype locomotive that was capable of going 65 miles per hour, a speed that at that time, back then, actually made it one of the fastest trains in the world. But the head of the Japanese railway system says, no, I don't think so, guys. Get back to work. That's not good enough. It's not even close, okay? The head of the railway system goes, he wanted a 120-mile-per-hour train, from 65 to 120 miles per hour. And the engineers are like, dude, we can't do that. That's impossible. It's just not realistic. It's not a realistic expectation. And in fact, it's actually a pretty dangerous undertaking because a train designed to go that fast, 120 miles per hour, along the sharp, mountainous Japanese topography would definitely derail if it turned too sharply, right? And it would end up killing everybody on board as a result, right? It's too dangerous. We can't do that. No possible way that they could design a train to go that fast. So instead of 120 miles an hour, the engineer said that, you know what, we can do 70 miles per hour, 75 miles per hour if we're lucky and we really design a tight system here with this train. Any faster, trains would just crash, can't do it. You know what the railway system head says? He goes, well, why do the trains need to turn anyway? Why do they need to turn? If that's the problem, why don't we make a train that doesn't need to turn? And the engineers go, well, there's tons of mountainous terrain between the cities. Remember, it needs to turn in order to get around these different mountains and this rough terrain. And the railway system head shoots right back. He goes, well, why don't we make tunnels then? There's an idea. tunnels. Now, the labor required to tunnel through that much territory could require just as many physical and financial resources as it did to rebuild the entire city of Tokyo after World War II. Right? So that's a lot of financial resources, a lot of energy, a lot of physical energy, a lot of people that they need to hire and contract in order to do that, right? To tunnel through so that the train doesn't need to turn or make any sort of weird turns in order to get from point A to point B, turn around these mountains, go around this different rough terrain in order to get from Osaka to Tokyo or from Tokyo to Osaka, right? To make that 300-mile trip as quickly as possible, because as you may know, the fastest way to get from one place to another, straight line, right? So that's what this guy is proposing. He's saying, let's just make this bad boy a straight line. And so long story short, 3 months after that conversation, the engineers come back to the railway chief with an engine that could go as fast as 75 miles per hour. And you could probably already guess that the railway chief wasn't really too happy about that. Right, 75 miles an hour has absolutely no chance of transforming the nation. Right, incremental improvements would only yield incremental economic growth. And the only way to revamp their transportation system, the Japanese transportation system, would be to build those tunnels, right, to punch through that mountainous terrain, make it a straight line, rebuild every single element of how these trains functioned. Everything, no matter what resources it required, he wanted to make that happen. So his team gets to work, right? And over the next 2 years, the engineers experimented. They tweaked. They designed train cars that each had their own motors. They rebuilt gears so that they meshed with less friction. They discovered that their new cars were too heavy for Japan's existing tracks, and so they reinforced the rails, which had the added bonus of increasing the train stability, which added another half mile per hour to the train speed. There were tons, hundreds of innovations, both big and small, just like these, each of which made the trains just a little bit faster than they were before. A little bit faster than they were before. And after tons of tiny little tweaks and years of hard work, heart, and hustle under the Japanese railway chief's go big or go home style of leadership, the very same team of engineers that thought it was absolutely impossible to build a 120-mile train ended up building a 120-mile train. And in 1964, the Tokaido Shinkansen, the world's first bullet train, left Tokyo and made its 320-mile trip towards Osaka, except this time, instead of taking 20 hours, the trip took only 4. From 20 hours to 4. That's huge, right? Now, I don't know about you, but I'd be pretty damn excited about shaving 16 hours off my travel time if I was a regular passenger on that train. And so soon enough, of course, other people heard about this and other bullet trains were running to other Japanese cities as well, which resulted in a massive, massive economic boost for the entire country of Japan. The development of the bullet train actually was critical in spurring Japan's growth well into the 1980s, helping it become what it is today, right? And within a decade of that innovation, the technologies developed in Japan actually served as a guide for several other high-speed trains in the Western world, in France, Germany, Australia, revolutionizing pretty much industrial design across the globe. Now, I've got a quick question for you. Do you think the railway chief sat down and set SMART goals before having his team design the bullet train? Not a chance, right? You'd laugh at that. Years after the first bullet train was introduced, a guy named Jack Welch, the former head of General Electric, who you've probably heard of, who, by the way, I think is actually a business genius, but a terrible bastard of a leader for many reasons, a few of which I've actually outlined on my blog at DeanBakari.com. You can read about that there. I'll link it up in the show notes. But anyways, Jack Welch actually heard this story, right? Former head of GE, heard about the story about this Japanese railway head who inspired his engineering team to build the world's first bullet train, right? And hear this very same story that I just told you. And he heard about it when he was in Japan touring a factory, one of his factories probably for GE. And he hears this story. He gets so inspired by it that he goes straight back to the States and immediately begins implementing a similar outlook over at GE, requiring every single person at the company to start practicing what he calls bullet train thinking, which meant it was time to start thinking big, really big, right? Instead of focusing on small, narrow goals that may have moved the needle for GE a little bit, but not enough to cause a tipping point, they started focusing on big, giant, audacious goals that galvanized people into action, forcing them to tap into creative capabilities that catapulted GE to insanely successful levels of prosperity and profit, all that good stuff. They were already a great company to begin with, and they were really known for using SMART goals, right, which is effective, but they weren't to the level of extraordinary success that they are today and have become under this guy's leadership. Now, they really became super profitable once they started implementing bullet train thinking. Now, again, in the book, Smarter, Faster, Better, Charles Duhigg actually details how Jack Welch implemented bullet train thinking over at GE, starting with a letter to his shareholders. Here's what he said. Now, going forward, every executive in every department, in addition to delivering specific and achievable and timely objectives, would also have to identify a stretch goal, an aim so ambitious that managers couldn't describe, at least initially, how they would achieve it. Everyone, Welch said, would have to partake in bullet train thinking. Now, in a 1993 letter to shareholders, Jack Welch goes that he says, stretch goals are a concept that would have produced smirks, if not laughter, in the GE of 3 or 4 years ago, because it essentially means using dreams to set big business targets, right, with no real idea of how to even get there. Now, here's what he says in this letter to shareholders, okay? He says, we're going to be doing these stretch goals, we're going to be doing bullet train thinking, and here's the thing. If you know how to get there, if you set a goal and you know how to get there, it's not a stretch target. So if you set a goal and you think it's realistic enough and you know exactly how to get there and you've developed a plan and it's specific and detailed and you know every little aspect of how you will achieve that goal, then it's not big enough. It's not a stretch target. Okay. So what I mean by stretch here, by the way, is that's the result of bullet train thinking. You know, bullet train thinking and stretch targets, stretch goal setting, pretty much the same thing, same idea. Okay. Now, 6 months after Welch's trip to Japan, every single division at GE had a stretch goal. The division manufacturing airplane engines, for instance, announced that they would reduce the number of deficits in finished engines by 25%. Now, in all honesty, the division's managers figured that they could hit that target pretty easily. Almost all the deficits they found on engines were small and they were cosmetic issues, tiny little things like slightly misaligned cable or unimportant scratches. They could pretty much fix them pretty easily, right? Anything more serious was corrected before the engine was shipped. If they hired more quality assurance guys, managers figured that they could reduce the cosmetic defects with little effort. Now check this out. Here's what Jack Welch said when he heard about that. He said, you know, I agree that reducing deficits is a wise goal. It's a smart thing to do. And then he said, instead of 25%, though, I want you to cut errors by 70%. Boom. Now, the managers were like, we can't do that. That's ridiculous. Manufacturing engines was such a complicated affair. Each one of these things weighed 5 tons and had more than 10,000 parts, right? There was no way they could achieve a 70% reduction in deficits and problems. Welch says, you guys got 3 years, right? You guys have 3 years to bring those issues down by 70%. Now, the division's managers started panicking at this point. They started analyzing every single error, every little detail that had been recorded in the previous 12 months. Simply hiring more quality assurance workers, they quickly realized, wouldn't do the trick. And the only way to reduce errors by 70% was to make every single employee, in effect, a quality assurance auditor. Everyone had to start taking responsibility for catching mistakes, both big and small. But most factory workers didn't know enough about the engines, right, to identify every small defect as it occurred. So the only solution then, the manager said, was a massive retraining effort, right? They'd have to start retraining all these guys. Except that didn't really work either. Even after 9 months of retraining, the error rate had fallen by only 50%, which is still quite large. So the manager started hiring workers with more technical backgrounds, the kind of people who knew what an engine ought to look like and therefore could more easily spot what was amiss, right? They could spot the problems. The GE factory manufacturing CF6 engines in Durham, North Carolina, determined that the best way to find the right employees was to hire only candidates with FAA certification in engine manufacturing, right, which really put them at the elite level. Workers like these, however, were already in high demand at other plants. So what did they do to attract them? Managers said employees could have more autonomy. They could have more control. They could schedule their own shifts and organize teams however they wanted to organize them. They could develop themselves as leaders. That required the plant to do away with centralized scheduling, right? In other words, micromanaging. These teams had to self-organize themselves and figure out their own workflow, right? In other words, they had control, which is super important to have control over what you do. Any goal, anything you're trying to accomplish, it's so important to not be micromanaged, but to be in control to a certain degree, right? Enough that you feel like you've got ownership and accountability over what you're doing. Now, Welsh had given his aircraft manufacturing division a stretch goal of reducing errors by 70%, right? An objective that was so insanely audacious that the only way to go about it was to change nearly everything about A, how workers were trained, B, which workers were hired, C, how the factory ran. And by the time they were done, the Durham plant's managers had collapsed organizational charts. They'd remade job duties. They overhauled how they interviewed candidates and clients and people that they were thinking about hiring because they needed people with better team skills and more flexible mindsets, right? In other words, Welsh's stretch goal set off this chain reaction that remade how engines were manufactured in ways nobody had ever imagined. It totally switched everything that they were doing, right? Almost like a keystone habit, right? When you start doing one thing, you know, you start to all of a sudden that positive new habit, for instance, say you start going to the gym, all of a sudden now that you've lost weight, you become a little bit more confident, a little bit more outgoing, a little bit more, you know, sure of yourself. All those things start to have, you know, all those positive effects start to come about in your life because you decided to make one big decision, which was, okay, I'm going to start going to the gym now. This is pretty much the same thing. That's kind of like what stretch goal setting is about. What Jack Welsh did here with the train railway head in Japanese did, right? He set a big giant goal, audacious goal, right? And then he said, now go after it. Figure out however you need to do, whatever things you need to do in order to figure that out. Let's get after it. Let's do it, right? So again, his stretch goal, back to Welsh here, set off this chain reaction that remade how engines were manufactured in ways that nobody else had ever imagined. By 1999, the number of defects per engine had actually fallen by 75%, 75%, not 70, and the company had gone 38 months without missing a single delivery, which was a brand new record for whatever industry, you know, this industry that they're playing in. And the cost of manufacturing on top of that dropped by 10% every year. And all these great, wonderful things happened, all because of this one big, giant goal, stretch goal of reducing errors by 70%, which they beat by 5%. They actually fell by 75%, which is huge, right? No smart goal would have ever done that. No smart goal would have ever done that, right? Tons of academic studies have examined the impact of stretch goals and have consistently found that forcing people to commit to ambitious, seemingly out of reach objectives can spark outsized, humongous jumps in innovation, productivity, and just overall effectiveness. Another study here outside of GE, is a study from Motorola, for instance. They found the time it took engineers to develop new products fell tenfold after the company mandated stretch goals throughout the firm. A study of 3M, the folks that make tape and double-sided tape and post-it notes and all that stuff, they said stretch goals helped spur inventions like Scotch tape and Thinsulate, right? Stretch goals transformed Union Pacific, Texas Instruments, the people who make those calculators, remember those? Now, Union Pacific, Texas Instruments, public schools in DC, LA, surveys of people who've lost large amounts of weight or have become marathon runners later in life found that stretch goals are often integral to their success. Why is that? Why are stretch goals so important, right? Why is that? Because stretch goals serve as sort of like a shock. They serve as jolting events that disrupt complacency, and they promote new ways of thinking, right? They get you to think differently about what you need to do. You're like, holy shit, this is so hard. This is such a big goal. It's so audacious, so seemingly impossible that I really need to just think in a totally different way. I need a paradigm shift to really figure out how to wrap my head around this and how to accomplish this if you're really serious about the goal, right? Now, a group of researchers, they wrote in 2011, the Academy of Management Review, this business journal, they wrote that by forcing a substantial elevation in collective aspirations, stretch goals can shift attention to potentially new futures and perhaps even spark increased energy in the organization or individual. Thus, they can prompt exploratory learning through experimentation, innovation, broad search, or playfulness, right? So do stretch goals work? In short, yes or no? Do they work? Yes or no? The catch, the caveat, the bottom line is this. Studies show that if a stretch goal is audacious, it can spark innovation. It can get you to think differently. It can cause panic, though, as well, and convince people that success is not even possible in the first place if the goal is too big. So there's a fine line between an ambition that helps people achieve something amazing and one that crushes morale, right? Again, this is the really, really important caveat to the power of stretch goals, okay? If the goal is audacious, if it's big enough, it can spark innovation. It can get you to think differently. It can inspire you to do things differently and figure out a new solution and actually achieve that goal. But if the stretch goal is too audacious, what happens? People panic, right? They think that it's not even possible. It's so big, I can't even do this, right? So there's a fine line between an ambition that helps people achieve something amazing and one that just crushes us, right? So for a stretch goal to inspire, what do you need to do? What do you need to do? How do you need to implement the stretch goal properly in order to get it to inspire you? Often, if you want the stretch goal to inspire, it needs to be paired with something like a smart system, right? The problem with smart goals oftentimes is people don't start with a stretch goal. They say, oh, I want to run 5 miles, you know, within whatever period of time. I think it's achievable if I run on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And is it realistic? Well, yeah, if I wake up early every day and I jog and work towards it. But it doesn't inspire, right? But what if you said, instead of I just want to be able to run 5 miles without stopping, what if you said, I want to run a marathon, the first marathon that I've ever run in my entire life. It's something that I've always wanted to do, and I'm going to start conditioning myself, start training myself in order to do that. What if you said, I want to, instead of working out every day and getting in better shape, what if you said, I'm going to enter into a bodybuilding competition, right? That'll jolt you, right? That'll get you going. Doesn't mean you need to become a professional bodybuilder or anything like that, but it gets you going, gets you inspired, gets you excited enough to continue pursuing whatever things you need to do in order to achieve that big, giant stretch goal. And even if you don't, oftentimes, you still end up achieving so much more than you would have if your goal was just mediocre, right? So the reason we need both stretch goals and smart goals is that audaciousness on its own can really scare us, right? It's often not clear enough how to start on a stretch goal. And so for a stretch goal to become more than just an aspiration, what we need to do is we need to develop a disciplined mindset to show us how to turn a far-off object into a series of realistic short-term aims, okay? So for a stretch goal to become more than just an aspiration, a lofty dream, we need to figure out how to break that bad boy down. And we use that, we use a SMART goal planning system, right? So we pair stretch goals with SMART goals. That's the key. So the bottom line is this. The Japanese railway chief, he started setting stretch goals company-wide, and it worked. GE started setting stretch goals company-wide, and it worked. You should start setting stretch goals, too, because it works. But wait, there's more. It's not just about bullet train thinking and setting stretch goals. Again, if you want to turn those big giant dreams and goals into reality, you need to pair those stretch goals with a specific plan of action. In other words, you've got to pair those stretch goals with SMART goals again. And that's the real recipe for success. How do you do that? That's what we're going to talk about in part two of this series. Okay, in part two of the series, what we're going to do is we're going to break this process down so you can learn exactly what you need to do to achieve your greatest goals in the smartest way possible. But for now, here's what I want you to do. As soon as we go off here, set your own stretch goal. Set a stretch goal. That's all you need to do right now. And then in the next episode, we're going to actually break it down and figure out what you need to do, the plan of action you need to develop in order to turn that stretch goal into a reality by pairing a stretch goal with a SMART goal planning system. Okay, I'm going to break all the details down for you with you in this next episode with examples and all that good stuff. But again, for now, do this. First, take out a journal, something to write with. Then write down a big, giant ambition. Write down a stretch goal. Right? Something that really gets you going, that juices you up, gets you pumped, gets you excited, right? Write down a stretch goal, okay? So a couple of years back, a stretch goal for me was quit my corporate job within 12 months and build a business based on something I love that pays me twice as much as I'm making with my corporate job. Guess what? I actually quadrupled that goal, financially speaking, right? I quadrupled it. So I'm making four times as much as I am now. And again, by the way, I don't like talking about this all the time because it just, and I rarely do, actually, because I'm not trying to say any of this to impress you. I'm just trying to say to impress upon you that certain things work, certain strategies work, certain mindsets are effective. And this is one of them. Take out a journal, write down a stretch goal, and really dream big. If you didn't dream big enough on the stretch goal that you wrote down, scratch it out. You know, scratch out the wannabe stretch goal and rewrite one that inspires the shit out of you. I'm serious. Write a big one, a big goal. Okay. And if it's way, 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 way too big, way too audacious, we'll figure it out. We'll tweak it later. But for now, don't limit yourself. It's a problem too many people have. They limit themselves. Don't do that. Write down something, dream big, a big, giant stretch goal. Okay. Again, what are stretch goals? Stretch goals are goals that are so big, so ambitious, so audacious that it can be difficult at first to see how they can ever be achieved at all, right? But if you pair that stretch goal with a SMART goal, then it'll become more realistic for you, okay? So some examples, again, you know, don't try to start a small business, try to start an empire. Don't go for the girl that will probably say yes. Go for the girl that's so drop-dead gorgeous that she makes you forget your own name. Don't try to help just one person, try to help a million people, okay? So go get your stretch goals down on paper. And once you've done that, you'll be ready for part two, where you'll learn how to pair your stretch goal with a SMART goal so you can finally reach up and grab those goals from up in the clouds and bring them down closer and closer until, boom, the day you realize that they're not lofty dreams anymore. They are now a reality. Yo, it's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com. Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.